From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some critics point to history when they take aim at school vouchers, but we'll chat with an expert who says that history is more complicated than the critics want to admit. Leaders in the University of North Carolina system have a new tool to keep track of key data points. You'll hear debate about the usefulness of compiling all that data. North Carolina lawmakers have set up a new committee to investigate a controversial fund. It was set up in connection with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. You'll learn why. Plus, we'll explain why a national group is wrong to tie lagging North Carolina math scores to the state's rejection of Common Core. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Hard to believe, but the midterm election is less than 2 months away. Now, if you are a bit confused about who and what will appear on your November ballot, you are not alone. Carolina Journal's Rick Henderson is here to end the confusion, we hope anyway, over the legal battles that have been affecting what will actually appear on the November ballot. Rick, of course, is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, which has been reporting literally every step of the way on all of these lawsuits. So, Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Well, first of all, as you and I are talking at this point, we believe that the printing of the ballots are going forward, that anything that was going to be resolved or needed to be resolved for this election is resolved, right?
As far as we know, there's one potential glitch still having to do with the Constitution Party's presence on the ballot and some issues there in federal court, but that looks like that's pretty much evaporated. So everything else looks like it's moved forward. It looks as if all the ballots can be designed, proofed, printed, distributed. And so perhaps we'll hit the September 22nd deadline, which was supposed to be the date that by which the ballots are ready and are available to be sent to absentee voters, especially military and people living overseas who are eligible to vote.
Now, the ballots, of course, are important every single election cycle for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, more and more, Rick, are trying to go to their county election website, see a sample ballot, mm-hmm. and be an informed and prepared voter. So that's a good thing. But this election cycle has been so tough because of a number of legal battles going on. Let's talk about a couple of them that have just been back and forth, back and forth. First of all, there had been a question over North Carolina's 13 congressional districts. Mm-hmm. And literally over which person could be on the ballot from which district. Give us a little insight into that one.
Well, that lawsuit now is yet to be resolved, if you will, but it's been put on hold until after the election. There were a number of parties filing lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of those districts, claiming that they were unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. So far, the courts have essentially gone along with that argument, but also have said that because of the timing of the various lawsuits and the time needed for resolution of the lawsuits, it was too late to do anything about them for this current election cycle. So what the very likely thing to happen is going to be when the U.S. Supreme Court returns for its October session, it will hear a challenge that's been posed that's before a three-judge panel right now claiming the districts are unconstitutional because they were racially gerrymandered and then deciding what the remedy should be. And that, of course, because the arguments won't even be heard until October, they won't affect anything dealing with this current election. But it's a fairly good bet that we're going to have new congressional districts for the 2020 cycle only.
Rick, from Carolina Journal's reporting on this issue, which, by the way, you can find folks at carolinajournal.com, it has been that the Supreme Court has, up to this point, ruled that you cannot base districts on race,
right,
that is unconstitutional. The question now seems to be, at the issue of how they're drawn in terms of partisan advantage.
Correct.
And that has been in the past why it has been so important which party, the major parties, Republicans or Democrats, were to win the election, which begins a new 10-year period of election districts.
Right. The issue, as your co-host Mitch Kokai has pointed out in the past, is that there is such a thing as a racial gerrymander in which you are drawing districts unfairly based on race. Every district drawing gerrymandering is partisan. Partisan gerrymandering is a bit of an oxymoron. It's a bit of a duplicative statement. But the courts have never actually determined if at some level districts can be drawn with too much partisan advantage in mind. And the courts have, over the past couple of decades, shown some interest in possibly determining if there was some magic formula that could determine how much partisanship is too much in the drawing of district lines. The courts haven't done it yet. They may do it in this forthcoming term, or they may still say, you know what, district drawing is inherently a political process, and it's something that the courts can't enter into so long as they're abiding by such principles as one person, one vote. They're not using race or gender or income or other sorts of unconstitutional basic rights to draw districts. But that the argument that's made quite often is that in the 1990s and in the 2000s, Republicans were winning the total statewide vote for the General Assembly, but Democrats were having a very disproportionate advantage in the way the districts were drawn and had disproportionate representation. And after 2010, the numbers flipped, and Democrats were making the same sort of arguments about Republicans. Although, again, the courts have never said that that there's such a thing as too much partisanship in district drawing.
That is the looming question. So just to summarize here, in terms of this November's midterm election, we know we're using the current maps for North Carolina's 13 congressional districts. So that is resolved for this election. It may change later, depending on court rulings. But for now, we know who the candidates are for those districts. Rick, also for the November election, there has been a lot of wrangling over the potential for 6 constitutional amendments to appear on the ballot. Voters would give an up or down vote to each of those 6. Are 6 going to appear on the ballot?
We're
going to
have all 6 there. We have now finally had all the challenges resolved. And of the 6, there are really 2 that are very straightforward and are not controversial as far as the language that was used for the amendments themselves. The issues themselves are very contentious, but the ballot measures themselves aren't. And one of those is the constitutional right to hunt and fish, which is now a statutory right, but not a constitutional right. And the second is a reduction in the cap on the state income tax level, currently set in the Constitution at 10%. This amendment would reduce it to 7%. Now, the language of those amendments is now never was very controversial, but the question again was whether or not they should appear on the ballot, and there were challenges about whether the legislature was actually able to do that. That's all been resolved.
Now, there are 4 others, 4 other constitutional amendments, and one of them has gotten a particular amount of media coverage. That has to do with requiring a photo ID to vote.
Yes, that's right. That's something that the courts federally have scrutinized very strongly over the years. And there are some states in which it is still unconstitutional to require an ID to vote because of the way that the ID itself has been structured and required by the various states. And so that's something that controversy in part about this was that the General Assembly did not specify what types of IDs would be allowed for people to vote. And the counter argument, which I find very compelling, is that they shouldn't do that in the state constitution because the federal courts could rule something completely different. They could rule that certain types of ID are not allowed, and so therefore your state constitutional amendment would be completely overturned, or at least portions of it would be. So the way this works, if voters say, yes, an ID should be required, then the General Assembly will come back and try to craft a law that makes those types of IDs consistent with the federal constitution.
Rick, victims' rights also will be on the ballot in the form of a constitutional amendment.
Right. Victims' rights currently are protected by the Constitution, but the current amendment would give victims of crimes or survivors of crimes and their families opportunity to have greater access to the courts during every part of the proceedings of a legal controversy dealing with crime victims.
You can read all of that at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some critics of school vouchers like to point to history. They say the school choice movement evolved from efforts to fight integration of public schools. Our next guest is here to correct the record. Philip Magnus is Visiting Assistant Professor of Economics at Barry College. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this really is something that you hear sometimes from people who oppose vouchers or school choice in general, that, wait a minute, you look back to the 50s and 60s, and this all started from people who wanted to fight the ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. Are they correct?
Right. So the issue is much more complicated than that. Vouchers do emerge simultaneously with an upheaval in the school system that takes place in the 50s and 60s, and integration is part of that. But there are also religious movements that are trying to seek alternatives to public education. But the big story here is the free market side, and that's Milton Friedman, who is kind of the father of the modern voucher movement. So he writes an article in 1955 that sketches out the theory behind vouchers, why competition in schools work. And there's actually a footnote in the article that's often overlooked by people who make this argument. And Friedman is explicit that he is an integrationist. He's a supporter of integrating the schools. And he actually sees vouchers as a means to undermine and defeat and work around segregation. And he even goes on record and says, if the choice were only between forced segregation, which is basically the status quo that they had, and using government tools to mandate integration, he would be unequivocally in the latter category. But he sees vouchers as a better mechanism to bring that about.
So basically, Friedman in his article stand entirely against this narrative that we've heard about
entirely,
the history of
yeah.
school choice.
Yeah.
Does he go on in that article to explain why he thinks vouchers would work better?
Right, right. So both in that article and then some of his later work, particularly his book Capitalism and Freedom, which comes out in the early 1960s, he develops an argument, says that if you allow competition to occur between schools, you'll basically enter into a marketplace for education. And he draws on the work of one of his students, Gary Becker, another future Nobel laureate. Gary Becker puts forth an economic model of why discrimination happens. And he basically says in the long run, discrimination is a very economically unprofitable mechanism. It's a tool that self-excludes part of your customer base from it. So Friedman's idea is that if you introduce choice into the education system, over time, integration will win out over segregation because it opens up a broader market share to students, to potential people that are competing to draw students into their schools. And then you add on top of that, you can make a moral case, moral suasion, Friedman says, is one of the great tools that we have to bring about integration. So he sees this as complementary to the voucher movement.
This sounds as if it's one of these cases that we've seen in other areas of our economy where free markets can help drive better results than government policy, even when the government policy is directed specifically toward integration, markets can work better to achieve the same goal.
Yeah. And that's a big component of Friedman's argument. It says, you know, the notion of choice brings people over to the right side of the issue rather than, you know, using the force of a mandate. So he's trying to not only solve the problem of segregation, but bring the populace on board. And he sees markets as a better mechanism to do that.
That is the voice of Philip Magnus. He is visiting assistant professor of economics at Barry College. Now, what you're talking about is so different than the narrative we hear from some of the critics. Why is this not better known?
Well, part of it is just a deficit in archival research. I've been digging into this issue pretty heavily for the past year or so. And one of the discoveries I made came out of Charlottesville, Virginia in 1959. There's actually an anti-voucher coalition that emerges around some members of the school board in Charlottesville. And the anti-voucher coalition teams up with the segregationists because they believe that vouchers are going to undermine this institution they're trying to maintain, desperately clinging to after the Brown decision. And the whole idea was that the courts had prohibited the local school board from forcibly segregating their school system. So that's off the table now. But they wanted to use backdoor segregation, which they did it through two mechanisms. You geographically zone the white and black students to different schools. And then to prevent them from crossing over into different zones, you have a very rigorous cap on enrollment that they'd enforce at the white schools. And there's a local attorney in Charlottesville by the name of John S. Battle, Jr. He's the son of a former governor, one of the main litigants against the NAACP and all these integration suits. And Battle says, wait a minute, if these vouchers pass, if they come into existence, some white students will leave the schools facing integration, but that opens up seats that black students could take. So he sees vouchers as kind of this threat to the system they're desperately trying to cling on to. So Battle's argument actually takes hold a little bit later in the story because Virginia does adopt a rudimentary tuition grant system in 1959, and they have to do it on race-neutral terms, even though there are some mixed motives that come in from segregation. But the big story that happens there is after the system comes into play, they start seeing who's using the vouchers. And it's not white students fleeing integrating schools. It's students of all colors that are seeking better schools, seeking an improved school system, whether public or private. So when they start doing statistical analysis of it, they find that most people that are using this voucher system are not using it for segregationist purposes. So this upsets the teachers union, which is still segregated at the time. And you've got as late as 1964, the Virginia Educators Association is taking a stance in favor of putting segregationist strictures on the voucher program because they think it's taking their money away.
As you present this information to people who believe the other narrative, the narrative that it's the segregationists who wanted the vouchers, are people surprised?
There is a bit of incredulity almost because this narrative becomes so ingrained on the other side. But the evidence is fairly overwhelming when you start seeing it printed in the teachers' union journals, their in-house journals and letters, their statements to the press where they are siding in favor of segregationist strictures on the voucher system. So it's hard to work around that from an evidentiary front. Now, it is still a complicated story. Segregation is only one of many different components that's going into what is playing out in terms of voucher politics. But I view my role as kind of bringing that complexity to the story that's missed by this this very simplified political narrative.
In the brief time that we have left, once people hear this real story, do you think that will help boost support for this notion of vouchers as a way to help improve education overall?
Yeah, I think it brings some more evidence to bear that's also consistent with the empirical results of what we're seeing from rudimentary voucher systems in action. And they do tend to break down barriers. So of the statistical studies that have been done of voucher systems performance and also alternative schools, charter schools, you find de facto segregation that previously existed just by where people live breaks down when you start introducing choice into that equation.
Well, it's a very interesting story, very interesting history. That was the voice of Philip Magnus, visiting assistant professor of economics at Berry College. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. UNC's Board of Governors recently reviewed a new dashboard. It contains multiple data points. They're designed to help the governors judge how well UNC campuses are performing. Board Chairman Harry Smith likes what he sees so far.
This is step one. And so, you know, we can take this tool and continue to expand upon it. And take it to as much depth and detail as you want. And so, you know, this is not a gotcha tool. This is a tool to help us start tracking accountability, transparency. It's also a tool that I think will clearly define which schools are really doing great things in operations and running their business and focused on success. And I think it will also clearly show that if we have a school that has incurred a challenge, so if we get a downward trend and we're seeing some of those, you know, what's going on there? And so, this is a mechanism to help us be proactive. What I have seen since I've been here is there's a heck of a lot of reactive.
Board member Bob Ruccio would like to see more information about UNC graduates and jobs.
If success is defined as educating and getting people employed, at one point we probably need to measure what our widgets are doing when they get out of this place 4, 5, or 6 years, whether they are employed and maybe at what level.
Board member Joe Knott reminded colleagues that jobs aren't the only way to gauge how well UNC campuses are performing.
Everyone needs a job when they get out of college. I understand that. But That is not the only measure of success. And as I've said before, ultimately the success of our university system, in my opinion, can't really be measured until the generation passes and if the culture is still standing. I mean, one of the great things that our universities do not only is to equip you or equip our students to make a living, but it also equips them to perpetuate and defend our civilization and culture. And as we see, if we get too focused just on working and making money and so forth, and the culture dissolves in a couple of generations, then we're all of our efforts have been for naught. So I just want to make that point. It's not merely employment, earnings, and so forth, but it's the perpetuation of our morality, our character, our courage, and the defense of our civilization against the encroachments of barbarianism.
Well, I had no doubt Jay would be deep. I'll tell you, I think most parents are concerned about kids getting a job. But, I'm going to soak up all what Joe said, and I have no doubt that there's deep meaning there.
That's UNC Board of Governors Chairman Harry Smith responding to comments from colleague Joe Knott. All of these comments responded to a new dashboard. It's designed to highlight useful data connected to the UNC system. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are raising new questions about Governor Roy Cooper. Republican Senator Paul Newton of Cabarrus County made a presentation to a key legislative committee.
I'm here today to address the question of whether there is sufficient evidence for this commission to form a subcommittee to further investigate the facts and circumstances surrounding the governor's creation of a $57.8 million discretionary fund in connection with the issuance of an essential environmental permit needed to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
Newton questions the language in a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU.
The governor had this MOU drafted in a manner to provide the governor with direct control over a $57.8 million fund that some have referred to as a slush fund. Article 5, Section 7 of the state constitution states that, quote, "No money shall be drawn from the state treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and an accurate account of those receipts and expenditures of state funds shall be published annually." So under the Constitution, the governor does not raise or appropriate funds. The legislature does. One day later, so that was January 24th, MOU was signed. One day later, on January 26th, the ACP partners were issued their long-delayed and critical 401 water quality permit by DEQ. That raised questions immediately about the relationship between this discretionary fund and the issuance of the water quality permit. There was, for some, a perception of pay-to-play.
Why set up a special legislative study group? Newton says the governor refuses to answer key questions.
The governor refused to address questions regarding the apparently unconstitutional nature of the MOU. The governor refused to explain his position that his $57.8 million discretionary fund was a, quote, "voluntary contribution," close quote, from the ACP partners. The governor refused to address questions regarding the ethical implications of accepting a voluntary contribution from the ACP in the form of a $57.8 million discretionary fund that under the terms of the MOU he had direct control over while his Department of Environmental Quality was reviewing a permit application that the ACP partners desperately needed. Adding to the confusion were the conflicting statements that were being made about the $57.8 million fund. While the governor called it a voluntary contribution, Representative Harrison said in media interviews that it was a required element to get the water quality permit and possibly was required by the Federal Migratory Bird Act. At least one ACP partner said the MOU was required by the FERC.
That's State Senator Paul Newton explaining why the General Assembly is seeking more information about a $58 million fund set up in connection with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Newton reminded colleagues about steps they've already taken in connection with the fund.
In Session Law 2018-2, the General Assembly redirected the $57.8 million from Governor Cooper's discretionary fund to schools in the counties that would be impacted by the ACP. Local educational officials in these rural counties enthusiastically supported this. Governor Cooper and Democratic leadership strongly objected to using the $57.8 million for schools in the rural counties impacted by the ACP. In his press conference on February 14th, Governor Cooper said that funding schools with the $57.8 million was a, quote, bad provision, close quote, and a, quote, power grab, close quote, and that this shift in funding somehow imperiled the agreement. Furthermore, on February 14th, the governor reiterated that leaving the money under his control in his discretionary fund was a, quote, good idea, close quote. Governor and Democratic leadership repeatedly stated that Session Law 2018-2 jeopardized the $57.8 million and that the ACP partners may refuse to provide the funding. I am not aware of any ACP partner that has expressed hesitation or concerns about funding the $57.8 million for schools in the impacted counties.
Newton cited more evidence involving the way the Atlantic Coast Pipeline Fund came together.
On December 13, 2017, the ACP partners proposed to provide MOU funding to the state of North Carolina, not to the governor, but to the state of North Carolina for mitigation of forest habitat, open space lands, water bodies, and natural resources. Funding was to be managed not by the governor, but by the Director of Wildlife Resources Commission. An important note here, in my personal opinion, had the governor signed that draft of the MOU, we would not be here talking about this today. But between December 13, 2017 and January 19, 2018, the governor's office modified and amended four different drafts of the MOU. Apparently, at the governor's insistence, the final MOU directed $57.8 million into a fund under the direct control of Governor Cooper. In one of the whereas clauses, the signed MOU stated that, quote, the governor, through his agents and assigns, et cetera, has the authority to direct the disbursement of funds contemplated in the Memorandum of Understanding. By what authority did Governor Cooper believe he had the right to obtain these funds and retain nearly unfettered discretion over how to appropriate the funds?
Newton wrapped up his presentation by explaining the key reason for seeking answers to unanswered questions surrounding the Atlantic Coast Pipeline Fund.
We need to assure current and prospective business leaders that there is no pay to play in North Carolina. If you have met all rules, regulations, and laws associated with any permit of any kind whatsoever in our state, and you've met the requirements, that issue should be issued, and you should get that permit. There should be no concern on any business leader's part that you will then be asked for a voluntary or involuntary cash contribution after having met the requirements for that permit.
Governor Cooper's chief of staff, Christy Jones, took issue with Newton's presentation.
The idea was created to have this fund that would ensure counties who were impacted by the Atlantic Coast Pipeline could get that access to natural gas. and actually just have the hope of creating jobs in eastern North Carolina. I'm going to remind you, permitting was and always is done separately by the Department of Environmental Quality. There is no secrecy in the executive branch. We announced the fund. It was always intended to benefit eastern North Carolina, and it's really unbelievable that you would even imply otherwise. In the executive branch, we have stringent ethic laws, conflict of interest laws, and other policies and procedures in place to handle all of these types of issues. And despite some's efforts to make this about anything other than economic development, the frivolous ethics complaint that was filed was quickly dismissed. So many interactions have happened between the governor's office and the General Assembly over the last 6 months. So many interactions. So I have to tell you, I was quite shocked and surprised when I found this to be the topic of today. There are so many other things we could be talking about today. And I urge you not to let politics get in the way of progress.
That's Christy Jones, Chief of Staff for Governor Roy Cooper. She's responding to news that the General Assembly plans to investigate circumstances surrounding a $58 million fund created in connection with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. New state test scores show performance in mathematics is essentially flat. Now, that's a concern for obvious reasons, but particularly since supporters of the Common Core standards had believed that the adoption of the Common Core framework would lead to higher achievement in North Carolina students. Dr. Terry Stoops is here to talk about the challenge North Carolina faces going forward and about a revision to those Common Core math standards that are set to begin this year. He, of course, is Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
When I saw your analysis of the recently released state test scores and saw that math scores were flat, that was a particular concern for me because all I hear about and see so much is the issue of jobs going forward in the STEM fields, one of which would be mathematics. So we should really be taking a look at that, should we not?
Absolutely. And when you look at the history of math scores in North Carolina, you see some very interesting things happen. So between 1992 and around 2009, 2011, we had incredible increases in math scores in North Carolina. And then something happened around 2009, 2011 that led to basically a flatlining of our math scores. And it's a trend that we've seen over the last few years, in particular on state tests. But if we look at the national tests, such as the National Assessment of Educational Progress, we saw that we made great progress in mathematics instruction in North Carolina, and then it flatlined. So that's really the larger concern here is, first, what led to those great increases in throughout the 90s and early 2000s in math performance, and then what of late has led to such a stagnation in state test score performance on mathematics tests?
Any ideas about what the answer to that question is?
Well, of course, I basically set it up that way because I had an idea. And in 2010, North Carolina adopted the Common Core state standards in math and English language arts. And I think that had a large role in the stagnation that we've seen of late in our math scores. Now, standards are basically what the teachers, all the essential ingredients that the teachers need to have in their curriculum at each grade level. So, of course, standards have a very large role in determining what students learn at each grade. It is whether you look at state tests or national NAEP tests, you see the same result that since around 2009, 2011, a stagnation in our state testing performance on mathematics. And the one thing, the large thing, the big thing that happened then was a large-scale change in the way we teach math via the adoption of the Common Core State Standards.
That's interesting because you're saying the change was in the way we teach it. So for someone like me who's not a teacher and an education expert like you are, I'm trying to figure out, is it that kids are being taught things or not being taught things they need to know, or is it just that the approach has changed and they're simply not absorbing that information like they used to?
Well, the approach has definitely changed, and I saw it as a parent more than as a policy analyst, because you started to see the homework that my children were bringing home that really didn't make any sense, that required more writing about math than actually doing math. Less emphasis on mastering certain skills through repetition and practice, and more emphasis in basically trying to learn how to, quote-unquote, apply those skills even though students hadn't mastered them. So as a parent, I saw the change in the way math was being taught, of what students were expected to know, and I think that our state and national test results bear the witness to the fact that the way that we taught math and way we were teaching math wasn't going to really give students what they needed to know, not only to perform well on tests, but to master the concepts that math requires them to master.
A lot of parents and some educators pushed back on Common Core standards. So what happened in North Carolina?
Well, the John Locke Foundation was one of a handful of groups that did push back on the Common Core standards. And we asked legislators to put together a panel, the Academic Standards Review Commission, to assess our math and reading standards. So in 2014, the state put together a panel to look at our state math and English language arts standards. And through 2015, they examined them. They had testimony. They had experts come in to talk about the standards. And it was in 2015 that there was a real fight about whether to get rid of the Common Core standards that we had adopted in 2010 or just modify them. Now, I wanted us to adopt a stronger set of standards, the Minnesota State math standards, which are widely considered to be the best in the nation. But unfortunately, the review commission did not go that route, and in 2015 recommended that the state revise the standards, the Common Core standards that they had in place. And that's what they did over the next 2 years.
That is going to be implemented starting this school year?
That's right. Starting the 2018-19 school year, we will see the revised standards in place. And if you look at the standards side by side, you don't see huge differences. In some places, they reformatted it so that it was easier to read and easier to understand. Only in a few places were the modifications large enough where they had to explain that some of the concepts that were maybe taught in one grade will be taught in another grade, or maybe taught in one part of the year as opposed to another part of the year. So we're not talking about a large-scale departure from Common Core. That is not what happened here. Instead, these were minor clarification standards that essentially used the framework of the Common Core as a basis for our standards and then made clarifying changes so that teachers and parents could better understand how the standards would be implemented.
So if there are advocates who want to criticize North Carolina and say, hey, well, their problem is that they got rid of the Common Core standards, that's not right.
That's not right at all. And in fact, I did see that the Fordham Institute, who were early Common Core proponents, were saying that North Carolina ditched the Common Core, and that's why they are rating our new math standards as weak. But that's absolutely not true. We didn't ditch Common Core. We made changes to the Common Core standards that they were strong advocates for back in 2010. In fact, they were one of the strongest advocates for the Common Core standards. And now that the Common Core hasn't borne the fruit that they thought it would, meaning it didn't increase student performance, now they are starting to pedal back a bit and look at states that are making small changes and criticize them for those changes.
Remind us of how the Common Core standards came about. This is really a federal, a national effort.
In many ways, yes. So there were some groups out of Washington, D.C. mainly, Achieve Incorporated and a couple others that developed these standards in 2009 and worked with the Obama administration to incentivize states to adopt these standards. And what they basically said was, if you adopt these standards, then you'll have a greater chance of receiving a Race to the Top grant, which, of course, a lot of states needed at that time because the Great Recession had hit. So they were desperate for money. North Carolina was one of the first to adopt the standards in 2010 with almost no public debate and very little media coverage except for the Carolina Journal of the adoption of the standards. We adopted them in 2010 and subsequently were awarded a Race to the Top grant.
Lastly, Terry, this has got to be a huge challenge for teachers.
Yeah, and it will take some time for them to get acquainted with the new standards and implement them, even though there weren't drastic changes.
You can read all of Terry Stoop's analysis of the issue at carolinajournal.com and johnlock.org. Dr. Terry Stoops, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.